This is disc number 7.
We all do what scientists call mental practice or mental rehearsing when we memorize answers for a test, learn lines for a play, or rehearse any kind of performance or presentation. But because few of us do it systematically, we underestimate its effectiveness. Some athletes and musicians use it to prepare for performances, and toward the end of his career, the concert pianist Glenn Gould relied largely on mental practice when preparing himself to record a piece of music. One of the most advanced forms of mental practice is mental chess, played without a board or pieces. The players imagine the board and the play, keeping track of the positions. Anatoly Sharansky, the Soviet human rights activist, used mental chess to survive in prison. Sharansky, a Jewish computer specialist falsely accused of spying for the United States in 1977, spent 9 years in prison, 400 days of that time in solitary confinement, in freezing, darkened, 5-by-6-foot punishment cells. Political prisoners in isolation often fall apart mentally because the use-it-or-lose-it brain needs external stimulation to maintain its maps. During this extended period of sensory deprivation, Sharansky played mental chess for months on end, which probably helped him keep his brain from degrading. He played both white and black, holding the game in his head, from opposite perspectives, an extraordinary challenge to the brain. Sharansky once told me, half-joking, that he kept that chess thinking he might as well use the opportunity to become the world champion. After he was released with the help of Western pressure, he went to Israel and became a cabinet minister. When the world champion Garry Kasparov played against the prime minister and leaders of the cabinet, he beat all of them except Sharansky. We know from brain scans of people who use massive amounts of mental practice what was probably happening in Sharansky's brain while he was in prison. Consider the case of Rüdiger Gahm, a young German man of normal intelligence who turned himself into a mathematical phenomenon, a human calculator. Though Gahm was not born with exceptional mathematical ability, he can now calculate the 9th power, or the 5th root of numbers, and solve such problems as, what is 68 times 76 in 5 seconds? Beginning at age 20, Gahm, who worked in a bank, began doing 4 hours of computational practice a day. By the time he was 26, he had become a calculating genius, able to make his living by performing on television. Investigators who examined him with a positron emission tomography, PET brain scan, while he was calculating, found he was able to recruit 5 more brain areas for calculating than normal people. The psychologist Anders Ericsson, an expert in the development of expertise, has shown that people like Gahm rely on long-term memory to help them solve mathematical problems when others rely on short-term memory. Experts don't store the answers, but they do store key facts and strategies that help them get answers, and they have immediate access to them as though they were in short-term memory. This use of long-term memory for problem-solving is typical of experts in most fields, and Ericsson found that becoming an expert in most fields usually takes about a decade of concentrated effort. One reason we can change our brain simply by imagining is that, from a neuroscientific point of view, imagining an act and doing it are not as different as they sound. When people close their eyes and visualize a simple object, such as the letter A, the primary visual cortex lights up, just as it would if the subject were actually looking at the letter A. Brain scans show that in action and imagination, many of the same parts of the brain are activated. That is why visualizing can improve performance. In an experiment that is as hard to believe as it is simple, Drs. Guang Yue and Kelly Cole showed that imagining one is using one's muscles actually strengthens them. The study looked at 2 groups, one that did physical exercise and one that imagined doing exercise. Both groups exercised a finger muscle Monday through Friday for 4 weeks. The physical group did trials of 15 maximal contractions, with a 20-second rest between each. The mental group merely imagined doing 15 maximal contractions with a 20-second rest between each, while also imagining a voice shouting at them, "Harder! Harder! Harder!" At the end of the study, the subjects who had done physical exercise increased their muscular strength by 30%, as one might expect. Those who only imagined doing the exercise for the same period increased their muscle strength by 22%. The explanation lies in the motor neurons of the brain that program movements. During these imaginary contractions, the neurons responsible for stringing together sequences of instructions for movements are activated and strengthened, resulting in increased strength when the muscles are contracted. This research has led to the development of the first machines that actually read people's thoughts. Thought translation machines tap into motor programs in a person or animal imagining an act, decode the distinctive electrical signature of the thought, and broadcast an electrical command to a device that puts the thought into action. These machines work because the brain is plastic and physically changes its state and structure as we think, in ways that can be tracked by electronic measurements. These devices are currently being developed to permit people who are completely paralyzed to move objects with their thoughts. As the machines become more sophisticated, they may be developed into thought readers, which recognize and translate the content of a thought and have the potential to be far more probing than lie detectors, which can only detect stress levels when a person is lying. These machines were developed in a few simple steps. In the mid-1990s at Duke University, Miguel Nicolelis and John Chapin began a behavioral experiment with the goal of learning to read an animal's thoughts. They trained a rat to press a bar, electronically attached to a water-releasing mechanism. Each time the rat pressed the bar, the mechanism released a drop of water for the rat to drink. The rat had a small part of its skull removed, and a small group of microelectrodes were attached to its motor cortex. These electrodes recorded the activity of 46 neurons in the motor cortex involved in planning and programming movements, neurons that normally send instructions down the spinal cord to the muscles. Since the goal of the experiment was to register thoughts, which are complex, the 46 neurons had to be measured simultaneously. Each time the rat moved the bar, Nicolelis and Chapin recorded the firing of its 46 motor programming neurons, and the signals were sent to a small computer. Soon the computer recognized the firing pattern for bar pressing. After the rat became used to pressing the bar, Nicolelis and Chapin disconnected the bar from the water release. Now when the rat pressed the bar, no water came. Frustrated, it pressed the bar a number of times, but to no avail. Next, the researchers connected the water release to the computer that was connected to the rat's neurons. In theory, now, each time the rat had the thought, press the bar, the computer would recognize the neuronal firing pattern and send a signal to the water release to dispense a drop. After a few hours, the rat realized it didn't have to touch the bar to get water. All it had to do was to imagine its paw pressing the bar, and water would come. Nicolelis and Chapin trained 4 rats to perform this task. Then they began to teach monkeys to do even more complex thought translations. Bell, an owl monkey, was trained to use a joystick to follow a light as it moved across a video screen. If she succeeded, she got a drop of fruit juice. Each time she moved the joystick, her neurons fired, and the pattern was mathematically analyzed by a computer. The pattern of neuronal firing always occurred 300 milliseconds before Bell actually moved the joystick, because it took that long for her brain to send the command down her spinal cord to her muscles. When she moved it to the right, a "move your arm right" pattern occurred in her brain, and the computer detected it. When she moved her arm to the left, the computer detected that pattern. Then the computer converted these mathematical patterns into commands that were sent to a robotic arm out of Bell's view. The mathematical patterns were also transmitted from Duke University to a second robotic arm in a lab at Cambridge, Massachusetts. Again, as in the rat experiment, there was no connection between the joystick and the robotic arms. The robotic arms connected to the computer, which read the patterns in Bell's neurons. The hope was that the robotic arm at Duke and in Cambridge would move exactly when Bell's arm did, 300 milliseconds after her thought. as the scientists randomly changed the light patterns on the computer screen and Bell's real arm moved the joystick, so did the robotic arms, 600 miles apart, powered only by her thoughts, transmitted by computer. The team has since taught a number of monkeys to use only their thoughts to move a robotic arm in any direction in three-dimensional space, in order to perform complex movements, such as reaching and grasping for objects. The monkeys also play video games, and seem to enjoy them, using only their thoughts to move a cursor on a video screen and zap a moving target. Nicolaus and Chapin hoped their work would help patients with various kinds of paralysis. That happened in July 2006, when a team led by neuroscientist John Donahue from Brown University used a similar technique with a human being. The 25-year-old man, Matthew Nagel, had been stabbed in the neck and paralyzed in all four limbs by the resulting spinal cord injury. A tiny, painless silicone chip with 100 electrodes was implanted in his brain and attached to a computer. After 4 days of practice, he was able to move a computer cursor on a screen, open email, adjust the channel and volume control on a television, play a computer game, and control a robotic arm using his thoughts. Patients with muscular dystrophy, strokes, and motor neuron disease are scheduled to try the thought translation device next. The goal in these approaches is ultimately to implant a small microelectrode array with batteries and a transmitter the size of a baby's fingernail in the motor cortex. A small computer could be connected either to a robotic arm or wirelessly to a wheelchair control or to electrodes implanted in muscles to trigger movements. Some scientists hope to develop a technology less invasive than microelectrodes to detect neuronal firing, possibly a variant of TMS or a device Taub and colleagues are developing to detect changes in brainwaves. What these imaginary experiments show is how truly integrated imagination and action are, despite the fact that we tend to think of imagination and action as completely different and subject to different rules. But consider this. In some cases, the faster you can imagine something, the faster you can do it. Jean Desity of Lyon, France, has done several different versions of a simple experiment. When you time how long it takes to imagine writing your name with your good hand and then actually write it, the times will be similar. When you imagine writing your name with your non-dominant hand, it will take longer both to imagine it and to write it. Most people who are right-handed find that their mental left hand is slower than their mental right hand. In studies of patients with stroke or Parkinson's disease, which causes people's movements to slow, Desity observed that patients took longer to imagine moving the affected limb than the unaffected one. Both mental imagery and actions are thought to be slowed because they both are products of the same motor program in the brain. The speed with which we imagine is probably constrained by the neuronal firing rate of our motor programs. Pascual Léon has profound observations about how neuroplasticity, which promotes change, can also lead to rigidity and repetition in the brain, and these insights help solve this paradox. If our brains are so plastic and changeable, why do we so often get stuck in rigid repetition? The answer lies in understanding first how remarkably plastic the brain is. Plasticina, he tells me, is the musical Spanish word for plasticity, and it captures something the English word does not. Plasticina, in Spanish, is also the word for Play-Doh or plasticine and describes a substance that is fundamentally impressionable. For him, our brains are so plastic that even when we do the same behavior day after day, the neuronal connections responsible are slightly different each time because of what we have done in the intervening time. I imagine, Pascual Léon says, that the brain activity is like Play-Doh one is playing with all the time. Everything that we do shapes this chunk of Play-Doh. But, he adds, if you start out with a package of Play-Doh that is a square, and you then make a ball of it, it is possible to get back to a square. But it won't be the same square as you had to begin with. Outcomes that appear similar are not identical. The molecules in the new square are arranged differently than in the old one. In other words, similar behaviors performed at different times use different circuits. For him, even when a patient with a neurological or psychological problem is cured, that cure never returns the patient's brain to its pre-existing state. The system is plastic, not elastic, Pasquale Leon says in a booming voice. An elastic band can be stretched, but it always reverts to its former shape, and the molecules are not rearranged in the process. The plastic brain is perpetually altered by every encounter, every interaction. So the question becomes, if the brain is so easily altered, how are we protected from endless change? Indeed, if the brain is like Play-Doh, how is it that we remain ourselves? Our genes help give us consistency up to a point, and so does repetition. Pasquale Leon explains this with a metaphor. The plastic brain is like a snowy hill in winter. Aspects of that hill, the slope, the rocks, the consistency of the snow, are, like our genes, a given. When we slide down on a sled, we can steer it, and we'll end up at the bottom of the hill by following a path determined both by how we steer and the characteristics of the hill. Where exactly we will end up is hard to predict because there are so many factors in play. But, Pasquale Leon says, what will definitely happen the second time you take the slope down is that you will more likely than not find yourself somewhere or another that is related to the path you took the first time. It won't be exactly that path, but it will be closer to that one than any other. And if you spend your entire afternoon sledding down, walking up, sledding down, at the end you will have some paths that have been used a lot, some that have been used very little, and there will be tracks that you have created, and it is very difficult now to get out of those tracks. And those tracks are not genetically determined anymore. The mental tracks that get laid down can lead to habits, good or bad. If we develop poor posture, it becomes hard to correct. If we develop good habits, they too become solidified. Is it possible, once tracks or neural pathways have been laid down, to get out of those paths and onto different ones? Yes, according to Pasquale Leon. But it is difficult because once we have created these tracks, they become really speedy and very efficient at guiding the sled down the hill. To take a different path becomes increasingly difficult. A roadblock of some kind is necessary to help us change direction. In his next experiment, Pasquale Leon developed the use of roadblocks and showed that alterations of established pathways and massive plastic reorganizations can occur at unexpected speed. His work using roadblocks began when he heard about an unusual boarding school in Spain where teachers who instructed the blind went to study darkness. They were blindfolded for a week to experience blindness firsthand. A blindfold is a roadblock for the sense of sight, and within the week their tactile senses and their ability to judge space had become extremely sensitive. They were able to differentiate makes of motorcycles by the sounds of their engines and to distinguish objects in their paths by their echoes. When the teachers first removed their blindfolds, they were profoundly disoriented and couldn't judge space or see. When Pasquale Leon heard about this school of darkness, he thought, let's take sighted people and make them absolutely blind. He blindfolded people for 5 days, then mapped their brains with TMS. He found that when he blocked out all light, the roadblock had to be impermeable. The subject's visual cortices began to process the sense of touch coming from their hands like blind patients learning Braille. What was most astounding, however, was that the brain reorganized itself in just a few days. With brain scans, Pasquale Leon showed that it could take as few as 2 days for the visual cortex to begin processing tactile and auditory signals. As well, many of the blindfolded subjects reported that as they moved or were touched or heard sounds, they began having visual hallucinations of beautiful, complex scenes of cities, skies, sunsets, Lilliputian figures, cartoon figures. Absolute darkness was essential to the change because vision is so powerful a sense that if any light got in, the visual cortex preferred to process it over sound and touch. Pasquale Leon discovered, as Taub had, that to develop a new pathway, you have to block or constrain its competitor, which is often the most commonly used pathway. After the blindfolds came off, the subject's visual cortices stopped responding to tactile or auditory stimulation within 12 to 24 hours. The speed with which the visual cortex switched to processing sound and touch posed a major question for Pascual Leon. He believed there wasn't enough time in 2 days for the brain to rewire itself so radically. When nerves are placed in a growth culture, they grow at most a millimeter a day. The visual cortex could have begun processing the other senses so quickly only if connections to those sources already existed. Pascual Leon, working with Roy Hamilton, took the idea that pre-existing paths were unmasked and pushed it one step further to propose a theory that the kind of radical brain reorganization seen in the School of Darkness is not the exception, but the rule. The human brain can reorganize so quickly because individual parts of the brain are not necessarily committed to processing particular senses. We can, and routinely do, use parts of our brains for many different tasks. As we've seen, almost all current theories of the brain are localizationist and assume that the sensory cortex processes each sense, sight, sound, touch, in locations devoted to processing them alone. The phrase visual cortex assumes that the sole purpose of that area of the brain is to process vision. Just as the phrases auditory cortex and somatosensory cortex assume a single purpose in other areas. But, says Pascual Leon, our brains are not truly organized in terms of systems that process a given sensory modality. Rather, our brain is organized in a series of specific operators. An operator is a processor in the brain that, instead of processing input from a single sense, such as vision, touch, or hearing, processes more abstract information. One operator processes information about spatial relationships, another movement, and another shapes. Spatial relationships, movement, and shapes are information that is processed by several of our senses. We can both feel and see spatial differences, how wide a person's hand is, as we can both feel and see movement and shapes. A few operators may be good for only a single sense, for example, the color operator, but spatial, movement, and shape operators process signals from more than one. An operator is selected by competition. The operator theory appears to draw on the theory of neuronal group selection developed in 1987 by Nobel Prize winner Gerald Edelman, who proposed that, for any brain activity, the ablest group of neurons is selected to do the task. There is an almost Darwinian competition, a neural Darwinism, to use Gerald Edelman's phrase, going on all the time between operators to see which ones can most effectively process signals from a particular sense and in a particular circumstance. This theory provides an elegant bridge between the localizationist emphasis on things tending to happen in certain typical locations and the neuroplastician's emphasis on the brain's ability to restructure itself. What it implies is that people learning a new skill can recruit operators devoted to other activities, vastly increasing their processing power, provided they can create a roadblock between the operator they need and its usual function. Someone presented with an overwhelming auditory task, such as memorizing Homer's Iliad, might blindfold himself to recruit operators usually devoted to sight, since the vast operators in the visual cortex can process sound. In Homer's time, long poems were composed and passed from generation to generation in oral form. Homer, according to tradition, was himself blind. Memorization was essential in pre-literate cultures. Indeed, illiteracy may have prompted people's brains to assign more operators to auditory tasks. Yet such feats of oral memory are possible in literate cultures if there is sufficient motivation. For centuries, Yemenite Jews taught their children to memorize the entire Torah, and today children in Iran memorize the entire Quran. We have seen that imagining an act engages the same motor and sensory programs that are involved in doing it. We have long viewed our imaginative life with a kind of sacred awe, as noble, pure, immaterial, and ethereal, cut off from our material brain. Now we cannot be so sure about where to draw the line between them. Everything your immaterial mind imagines leaves material traces. Each thought alters the physical state of your brain synapses at a microscopic level. Each time you imagine moving your fingers across the keys to play the piano, you alter the tendrils in your living brain. These experiments are not only delightful and intriguing, they also overturn the centuries of confusion that have grown out of the work of the French philosopher René Descartes, who argued that mind and brain are made of different substances and are governed by different laws. The brain, he claimed, was a physical, material thing, existing in space and obeying the laws of physics. The mind, or the soul as Descartes called it, was immaterial, a thinking thing that did not take up space or obey physical laws. Thoughts, he argued, were governed by the rules of reasoning, judgment, and desires, not by the physical laws of cause and effect. Human beings consisted of this duality, this marriage of immaterial mind and material brain. But Descartes, whose mind-body division has dominated science for 400 years, could never credibly explain how the immaterial mind could influence the material brain. As a result, people began to doubt that an immaterial thought or mere imagining might change the structure of the material brain. Descartes' view seemed to open an unbridgeable gap between mind and brain. His noble attempt to rescue the brain from the mysticism that surrounded it in his time, by making it mechanical, failed. Instead, the brain came to be seen as an inert, inanimate machine that could be moved to action only by the immaterial, ghost-like soul Descartes placed within it, which came to be called the ghost in the machine. By depicting a mechanistic brain, Descartes drained the life out of it and slowed the acceptance of brain plasticity more than any other thinker. Any plasticity, any ability to change that we had, existed in the mind, with its changing thoughts, not in the brain. But now we can see that our immaterial thoughts, too, have a physical signature, and we cannot be so sure that thought won't someday be explained in physical terms. While we have yet to understand exactly how thoughts actually change the brain structure, it is now clear that they do, and the firm line that Descartes drew between mind and brain is increasingly a dotted line. Chapter 9. Turning Our Ghosts into Ancestors. Psychoanalysis as a Neuroplastic Therapy. Mr. L. had been suffering from recurring depression for over 40 years and had had difficulties in his relationships with women. He was in his late 50s and had recently retired when he sought help from me. Few psychiatrists at the time in the early 1990s had any sense that the brain was plastic, and it was often thought that people approaching 60 were too fixed in their ways to benefit from a treatment that aimed not only to rid them of symptoms, but to alter long-standing aspects of their character. Mr. L. was always formal and polite. He was intelligent, subtle, and spoke in a clipped, spare way, without much music in his voice. He became increasingly remote when he spoke about his feelings. In addition to his deep depressions, which had responded only partially to antidepressants, he suffered from a second strange mood state. Often he was struck, seemingly out of the blue, by a mysterious sense of paralysis, feeling numb and purposeless, as though time had stopped. He also reported that he drank too much. He was particularly upset about his relations with women. As soon as he got romantically involved, he would start backing off, feeling that there is a better woman elsewhere whom I'm being denied. He had been unfaithful to his wife on a number of occasions and, as a result, lost his marriage, an outcome he greatly regretted. Worse, he wasn't sure why he was unfaithful because he had a lot of respect for his wife. He tried many times to get back with her, but she refused. He was uncertain what love was, had never felt jealous or possessive of others, and always felt women wanted to own him. He avoided both commitment to and conflict with women. He was devoted to his children, but felt attached through a sense of duty rather than joyful affection. This feeling pained him because they were doting and affectionate to him. When Mr. L was 26 months old, his mother died giving birth to his younger sister. He didn't believe that her death had affected him significantly. He had 7 siblings, and now their sole provider was their father, a farmer, who ran the isolated farm on which they lived without electricity or running water in a destitute county during the Great Depression. A year later, Mr. L became chronically ill with a gastrointestinal problem that needed continual attention. When he was 4, his father, unable to care for both him and his siblings, sent him to live with a married but childless aunt and her husband 1,000 miles away. In 2 years, everything in Mr. L's short life had changed. He had lost his mother, his father, his siblings, his health, his home, his village, and all his familiar physical surroundings, everything he cared about and had been attached to. And because he grew up among people used to enduring hard times and to keeping a stiff upper lip, neither his father nor his adoptive family talked much about his losses with him. Mr. L. said he had no memories from age 4 or earlier, and very few from his teenage years. He felt no sadness about what had happened to him, and never cried, even as an adult, about anything. Indeed, he spoke as though nothing that had happened to him had registered. "Why should it?" he asked. "Aren't children's minds too poorly formed to record such early events?" Yet there were clues that his losses did register. As he told his story, he looked, all those years later, as though he were still in shock. He was also haunted by dreams in which he was always searching for something. As Freud discovered, recurring dreams, with a relatively unchanging structure, often contain memory fragments of early traumas. Mr. L. described a typical dream as follows. "I am searching for something, I know not what, an unidentified object, maybe a toy, which is beyond familiar territory. I'd like it back again." His only comment was that the dream represented a terrible loss, but remarkably, he did not link it to the loss of his mother or family. Through understanding this dream, Mr. L. would learn to love, change important aspects of his character, and rid himself of 40 years of symptoms in an analysis that lasted from age 58 to 62. This change was possible because psychoanalysis is, in fact, a neuroplastic therapy. 4 years now, it has been fashionable in some quarters to argue that psychoanalysis, the original talking cure, and other psychotherapies are not serious ways to treat psychiatric symptoms and character problems. Serious treatments require drugs, not just talking about thoughts and feelings, which could not possibly affect the brain or alter character, which was increasingly thought to be a product of our genes. It was the work of the psychiatrist and researcher Eric Kandel that first interested me in neuroplasticity when I was a resident at the Columbia University Department of Psychiatry, where he taught and was a major influence on everyone present. Kandel was the first to show that as we learn, our individual neurons alter their structure and strengthen the synaptic connections between them. He was also first to demonstrate that when we form long-term memories, neurons change their anatomical shape and increase the number of synaptic connections they have to other neurons, work for which he won the Nobel Prize in 2000. Kandel became both a physician and a psychiatrist, hoping to practice psychoanalysis. But several psychoanalyst friends urged him to study the brain, learning, and memory, something about which very little was known, in order to deepen the understanding of why psychotherapy is effective and how it might be improved. After some early discoveries, Kandel decided to become a full-time laboratory scientist. But he never lost interest in how the mind and brain change in psychoanalysis. He began to study a giant marine snail called a plesia, whose unusually large neurons, its cells are a millimeter wide and visible to the naked eye, might provide a window into how human nervous tissue functions. Evolution is conservative, and elementary forms of learning function the same way, both in animals with simple nervous systems and in humans. Kandel's hope was to trap a learned response in the smallest possible group of neurons he could find and study it. He found a simple circuit in the snail, which he could partially remove from the animal by dissection and keep alive and intact in seawater. In this way, he could study it while it was alive and while it learned. A sea snail's simple nervous system has sensory cells that detect danger and send signals to its motor neurons, which act reflexively to protect it. Sea snails breathe by exposing their gills, which are covered by a fleshy tissue called a siphon. If the sensory neurons in the siphon detect an unfamiliar stimulus or danger, they send a message to 6 motor neurons that fire, causing the muscles around the gill to pull both siphon and gill safely back into the snail, where they are protected. This is the circuit that Condell studied by inserting microelectrodes into the neurons. He was able to show that as the snail learned to avoid shocks and withdraw its gill, its nervous system changed, enhancing the synaptic connections between its sensory and motor neurons and giving off more powerful signals detected by the microelectrodes. This was the first proof that learning led to neuroplastic strengthening of the connections between neurons. If he repeated the shocks in a short period, the snails became sensitized so that they developed learned fear and a tendency to overreact even to more benign stimuli, as do humans who develop anxiety disorders. When the snails developed learned fear, the presynaptic neurons released more of the chemical messenger into the synapse, giving off a more powerful signal. Then he showed that the snails could be taught to recognize a stimulus as harmless. When the snail's siphon was touched gently over and over and not followed with a shock, the synapses leading to the withdrawal reflex weakened, and the snail eventually ignored the touch. Finally, Condell was able to show that snails can also learn to associate 2 different events and that their nervous systems change in the process. When he gave the snail a benign stimulus, followed immediately by a shock to the tail, the snail's sensory neuron soon responded to the benign stimulus as though it were dangerous.